Hi there again, my name's Todd Fraser and I'm here with another ANZIC CTG podcast from the 19th annual CTG meeting from the beautiful Noosa Heads. Joining me on this episode is Dr. Sean Bagshaw from the University of Alberta in Canada to discuss their upcoming trial, START AKI. Sean, welcome. Thanks for participating in the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me, Todd.
So there's a theory out there that earlier dialysis in acute injury will enable people to do better. So what's the basis for this assertion?
That's certainly one of the hypotheses, that earlier initiation of renal replacement therapy in patients who have severe acute kidney injury who are critically ill may afford greater opportunity for correcting some of those metabolic fluid overload complications that are occurring. And hence, this may improve a patient's organ dysfunction, this may improve the patient's non-renal organ dysfunction, and enable a faster recovery. And in essence, may in fact promote renal recovery downstream. But to be honest, I think based on the data that's been published over the last 15 or 20 years on this topic, we are uncertain of whether that earlier strategy is in fact better for patients. It comes at a cost. And the cost is that you get dialysis catheters, that you get your blood exposed to an extracorporeal circuit, that you're on renal replacement therapy earlier than you might otherwise be in a different strategy.
Yep. So one of the very nebulous concepts in ICU over the last couple of decades has been the indications for starting dialysis. Where does the evidence suggest that that sits right now?
So in part of the preparatory work we did for this trial, you know, we did a few things. One, we looked at the, you know, available evidence, and we found that it was relatively suboptimal quality. It wasn't sufficient quality enough to inform what we should be doing at the bedside. We also surveyed our colleagues from critical care and nephrology and said, okay, what do you do under these circumstances? When do you start renal replacement therapy? And we found that there was huge variation in what clinicians constituted the minimum criteria by which they would start renal replacement therapy. So already we had indications that there's wide variation in practice. Then we did some observational work to say, okay, you told us what you do, but let's see exactly what you do. And again, there was wide variation in how patients were started on renal replacement therapy for what indications at what time. Mm. So that created significant challenges for designing a trial that's going to try to address this issue, which still many in critical care nephrology think is probably the most important question we need to still answer. What we've done is we've designed a trial that looks at not specific criteria, but strategies around initiating renal replacement therapy in patients. So an early or accelerated strategy versus a delayed or conservative or standard strategy. And that's how we sort of frame the question, recognizing that in the early strategy, this is a patient with severe acute kidney injury who's critically ill and has multi-organ dysfunction. They're going to get it put on early with the expectation or the hypothesis that, you know, we're going to treat the AKI, we're going to correct the correctables, and then patients will get better. Alternatively, the conservative strategy really is one where it's delayed, initiated based on actual complications starting to evolve in acute kidney injury, hyperkalemia, acidosis, fluid overload, azotemia, those kinds of complications. But in the delayed strategy as well, we recognize that not everybody necessarily will need to start renal replacement therapy. Our clairvoyance about who's going to get worse as clinicians is not perfect. Mm. And therefore, we do expect some patients in that delayed or standard or conservative strategy will recover and not need it, or will die before receiving it. And in our pilot trial, in preparation for this larger multinational trial, we showed that about, 63% of patients in that conservative arm received renal replacement therapy. About three quarters of them actually survived and received renal replacement therapy.
Yeah. Right. When you're constructing a trial like this, how do you stop the two arms merging together as people, if you've got one group who are effectively treated along traditional lines, as people start to understand the literature better and become more aware, how do you stop those two arms drifting together?
So that's obviously one of the challenges in conducting clinical trials of this nature. And, one of the things we need to do as investigators is really educate our sites, our site investigators, and anyone involved in the trial about what is the underlying or fundamental question we're trying to answer, so that they're not intimidated by the idea that early sometimes is earlier than they would normally do in their usual practice. Mm. And that delayed is maybe in some respects not totally aligned with their usual practice. I mean, the idea is that we want to provide two arms with separation within the context of current standards of care. And earlier being just that, and delayed being just that, right, in response to complications.
Yeah. So the other risk, I guess, is that you could artificially push that control arm away from normal practice, if you imagine my hypotheticals there. Is that a risk with something like this?
It is a concern. And one of the things that we've tried to sort of embed in the trial is the issue of equipoise. So in all the scenarios where you're enrolling an eligible patient, we do want the providers, the intensive care physicians and the nephrologists, to have equipoise about enrolling a patient. Clinicians are pretty intuitive. They have pretty good judgment, even though they may not know the right answer to this question, and we don't think they do. But the point is, sometimes in clinical practice, if you're resuscitating a patient, let's say with sepsis, and you've given them fluid and vasopressors, and you've been at the bedside for 6 or 12 hours, you've seen their evolution in physiology and their response to treatment. And sometimes you know they're going to recover very quickly. Mm. And that, you know, the next creatinine that you measure is going to come down, and that their organ function is responding to the resuscitation. They're getting better. Those are kinds of patients that we probably don't want to enroll in the trial, because they're getting better so quickly that the question that we have fundamentally, earlier versus delayed strategies, probably doesn't apply. Yeah. So we do give the investigators and the bedside providers some opportunity to provide their equipoise in the trial, which is a unique aspect of the design that hasn't been looked at in prior studies.
Yeah. Now, you referred earlier to there's an expectation that some of those patients who are in the early group probably wouldn't require dialysis if they were in the later group. Yeah. If this subsequently shows that there's no benefit, there's obviously a group of patients who have been unnecessarily treated, as it were. So how do you get around that as a problem?
So again, what I tell my sort of, what I would respond to that question by saying is this. The fundamental study question is that earlier strategy associated with an improvement in patient-centered outcomes, right? Yep. So we don't have the answer to that question. Yep. The only way to know that is to do this trial, right? So we do this trial, and I think the results of this trial are going to be win-win for two reasons. One, if we show that earlier initiation of renal replacement therapy in these sick, critically ill patients who the clinicians have equipoise, they're not sure what's going to happen, if they do better, that's probably going to change clinical practice, and there's going to be a sway towards sort of earlier initiation of renal replacement therapy. Yep. That might reinforce some providers' practice, and that might change others.
Yeah.
But alternatively, if we don't show any improvements, let's say in survival or kidney recovery to dialysis independence, if we don't show that, the trial findings are still going to have very important implications for health resource utilization. So we will be able to say with some confidence, in particular after doing a formal economic analysis, to say, you know what, a strategy of watching and waiting in this clinical context is probably resource less intensive and less costly to the system, and is a reasonable approach in terms of patient outcomes. So I think it's win-win, and it's going to inform clinical practice regardless.
You referred to the economic analysis there. I mean, that's obviously going to be one of the major potential side effects, as it were, of the earlier strategy. Can you tell us about that analysis and what that'll involve?
So that's something that we've planned as part of the trial from the beginning, that, you know, once we have the trial completed, we have patient data, we're going to follow patients out at 90 days and even 1 year. We're going to get some measure of health utility, and then we're going to do a formal health economic analysis or health economic evaluation of the two strategies and whether one is less cost resource intensive than the other. My suspicion would be is if the outcomes in terms of survival or kidney recovery are no different, there may be implications just with costs related to the dialysis, but there might be other cost related phenomenon like, you know, ICU stay, hospital stay, even other out of hospital costs that we're not completely aware of at present. So I think it's in this sense, when you're looking at two strategies with health technology involved, doing a formal cost effectiveness and health economic evaluation is absolutely critical.
So it's more than just the cost of the consumables and the time and delivery of the therapy. There's a whole lot of other factors that come into that analysis.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. It does raise the question, which is part of a general concern about some studies in ICU, when you're basing a therapy on a continuous variable, trying to work out which of the, you know, almost infinite number of potential thresholds. How do you get around that sort of problem in clinical trials?
Well, I think a lot of clinical trials that are at the phase two level or pilot trials that are trying to understand feasibility and, you know, clinical separation between two treatment arms to move on to more definitive trials, it's those phase two trials where we have difficulty in understanding what's the optimal endpoints to measure to say, look, this is physiologically or biologically plausible and this is feasible. Let's move on to a trial now that's larger in scope but much more cost and resource intensive to operate or to organize for a patient-centered outcome such as mortality, such as specifically dialysis dependence or quality of life or some of these other major patient-centered endpoints.
So whereabouts are you up to with the trial? Where is it in its evolution?
So the trial is now active in 7 countries at 55 centers, and we've enrolled, as of today, 366 patients. So we're happy. We have, obviously, the trial has initiated in Canada. We have about 31 active centers there. We have been running the trial here in Australia and New Zealand for about a year as a vanguard phase to help secure funding locally, which we've been successful in, thankfully. So we've had a site initiation or an investigator meeting here in Noosa to get another 12 to 15 sites up and running in the next few months. So we're very happy with Australia and New Zealand. They're going to be obviously strong and major contributors to this effort. But we do have centers enrolling now in Ireland, in France, in the United States, and we have engagement from a number of other European countries and some other countries that haven't been as involved in clinical trials, such as Brazil and in particular China.
If there's anyone listening to this podcast who's interested in getting involved, how would they do so?
So the best way would be you could contact me directly at my email, bagshaw@ualberta.ca, or you could certainly visit the website for Start AKI, which is available, or you can tweet us, and we can certainly contact you through that way. Our tweet is @AKIStart. That would be the best ways to contact us and find out more information about the trial.
Sean Bagshaw, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for joining me again on this ANZIC CTG podcast. For more episodes, please check out my blog at www.essentialcriticalcare.com.